from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. This is Hal Kempfer, and I'm going to talk about the Western Hemisphere. I know there's plenty else going on in the world right now. You know, certainly we could talk about Ukraine and Russia, and certainly big events going on with the frozen Russian assets, but I kind of wanted to bring it back home. And the reason why is there's a lot happening here in the hemisphere. There's a lot going on with American foreign policy, American policy in general. And I really want to hone in on some of the strategic shift that's happening and maybe put some historical context. I have to tell you, I've said this before, that at least in the media space, the use of the word unprecedented has truly been unprecedented. And I often hear that and I say, well, actually, it's quite precedented. It's happened before. It just hasn't happened recently. And there seems to be almost a myopic view. It's like, well, we haven't seen this. And it's true. We haven't seen it in decades. In some cases, we haven't seen it in centuries. But it's not something that's brand spanking new. And frankly, there's things happening around the world that we keep hearing are unprecedented that are also, again, very precedented, that I think we need to kind of put into a historical context. So let me talk about what's happening in the Western Hemisphere, what some are calling the Monroe Doctrine 2.0 or a return to the Monroe Doctrine. But let me just kind of go back and explain what the Monroe Doctrine is. Let me take you back to that. Some of you may not recall all the events of 1823, but the Monroe Doctrine has been a United States foreign policy position for obviously a very long time. And basically what it was is just telling Europe, we oppose European colonialism in the Western Hemisphere. Now, at that time, there was a lot going on. Spain, obviously, was very involved in the Western Hemisphere. France was very involved. Britain was very involved. Portugal was very involved. There was just a lot going on. But there were also independence movements happening throughout the Western Hemisphere. You know, obviously, the first country that broke the European colonial yoke was the United States. And we were basically saying, hey, look, we don't want to see more European colonialism in the Western Hemisphere. And I'm not saying that our putting that out as a doctrine necessarily thwarted the ambitions of these much more powerful European powers, but it did. It was a standard that established the U.S. I think it was our first really big foreign policy initiative of any type. It holds that any intervention in the political affairs of America's in the Americas, and that's North and South Americas, by a foreign power is potentially a hostile act against the United States. And it was central to our, what would some say was our grand strategy of the 20th century. The Trump administration kind of hit the ground running when they came in, kind of throwing these things out there. And they talked about some things which really go into the Western Hemisphere. Among other things, he talked about the U.S. potentially assimilating Greenland and assimilating Canada, which I will say sounds very colonial power type of thing in a lot of people's ears. And it was brought up at the time, which is like, I thought we were past the days when big powers would go out there and try to assimilate little powers. By the way, isn't that the sort of thing that we're trying to stop happening over in Ukraine? And this is true. However, I think he kind of sees it, President Trump sees it a little bit differently. And he also threatened to retake the Panama Canal Zone, which again, sounded like the U.S. exerting power and trying to reinvoke its colony holding footprint, if you will, in the Western Hemisphere. It appeared to many that he had been listening to historians who'd been taking little tidbits out there and of history, throwing that out there is like, wasn't this interesting, and not providing some of the broader current context of what these things would be. But since the 19th century, the U.S. has made several attempts to do things like purchase the very large island of Greenland from Denmark, and it is a Danish territory, which most do know, seem to know now. It's very, very independent in how it's governed, but it is a Danish territory. And one of the reasons that he was looking at that was he was referring back to something in 1917, where we acquired the Danish West Indies, and or what is now called the U.S. Virgin Islands. And of course, he's familiar with that. You know, the hurricanes have hit down that region, and as president, he had to deal with that. But that was the Danish West Indies. So, and in that agreement, there was some very vague language, which some say that they gave the U.S. the power to invoke control over Denmark, and some point to that. Others would say you're really reading into whatever that document said. But there have been notable discussions with the U.S. government about acquiring Greenland. I mean, go back to 1867, 1910, 1946, 1955, 2019 under Trump, 2025, obviously this year. And that acquisition has been advocated by a variety of secretaries of state. William Seward, if you remember Seward's Folly, the acquisition of Alaska, which actually turned out to be a pretty good deal. Secretary of State James Byrne, Vice President, very privately, Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, who was Gerald Ford's vice president, had talked about this. And of course, President Trump has talked about it very publicly. After World War II, the U.S. had secretly offered to buy Greenland. And as you may recall, in World War II, Denmark was occupied, overthrown, if you will, by the Nazis, by Germany. And so basically, anything done militarily in the defense of Greenland fell on the United States throughout that entire war. And there was public discussion about purchasing Greenland in 2019 and again after the 2024. In fact, actually, before 2025, President Trump had kind of thrown that out there and stuff. And it was seen as kind of an expansionist U.S. policy shift. Now, in May of this year, he said he couldn't rule out the U.S. annexation of the island. And obviously, Denmark was not pleased with that. And let's just say that there's been a lot of discussion throughout this thing overall. So Denmark has pretty much put it out there, as well as Dane, as far as Greenland's people and Greenland's own government has put out there, that Greenland is not for sale. All right. And so as far as the U.S. acquiring it, through a purchase like we did with the Danish West Indies, that is not something out there. Now, the Greenlanders support independence. And ironically, in a kind of a twist on the doctrine, we seem to be putting our fingers on the scale with a recent Greenland election. There's not a lot of Greenlanders, period. But to kind of push for maybe a government that would be a little more open to the U.S. Entrees of assimilating Greenland. And interestingly, it was even tossed up something I'm kind of familiar with from my years working across the Pacific in the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Palau. There was even talk that maybe it would shift and become something like a compact state. It would be independent, but it would be in free association with the U.S. That's an interesting idea. I still think that actually is an interesting idea in and of itself. But that's some of the stuff going on there. Now, there have been, if I can kind of switch gears with Canada, there have been movements within Canada for years have talked about the U.S. annexing either all of Canada or part of Canada or Western Canada. And you may recall the Quebecois, the Quebec independence movement of the 1970s. And the, you know, they've kind of got an agreement of sorts that say, you know, bilingual country, everybody has to learn English and French, but obviously in Western Canada, they don't really speak French. That was something that was imposed by keeping Quebec within the part of as part of Canada, and that everybody has to be bilingual. But you got two different distinctive cultural things going on, and there's been talk about, well, maybe English-speaking Canada would become part of the United States. All these things have happened before, and it goes back. I mean, before the U.S. even declared independence, or efforts to have what is part of Canada join the 13 colonies and join in their complaint against Great Britain. American forces tried to invade Canada, the invasion of Quebec in 1775. There was another attempt to kind of do something in 1812. There was an American diplomatic effort made in the aftermath of the American Civil War and the Confederation of Canada, but the 1871 Treaty of Washington kind of put all that to bed, and all that discussion ended. But there was a period of time in the United States politics that goes back to the first most would say kind of the first century of the country, that there was a lot of talk about Canada becoming that. And I remember when I was learning tactics as a young infantry officer, we were studying the night attack, and they were kind of going through some of the historical examples. And they said, you know, you really need to stay in the night attack, because the consequences of losing in the night attack could be fairly serious. We'll give you an example. Canada. And it took us all a second to kind of catch what the meaning was. But the meaning was that there was a failed American night attack when we were going north to try and establish a presence. This is during the War of Independence. Establish a presence in Canada to get Canada to kind of join in with the United States, that went completely sideways. And it kind of brought it home in a kind of strange way, but it was interesting. And who thinks of that? Well, there are historians who do think of it. All right. And so kind of one of those things, and he brought that out there. I think he says it. Obviously, there's a lot of rhetorical back and forth, a little tension between the U.S. and Canada, certainly on the trade front, a lot of tension, but kind of interesting. And then the Panama Canal, and this kind of, you know, I used to be stationed in Panama. When we owned the canal, that goes back to the Panama Canal Treaty. All right. That was something. We actually had an agreement with them that was entered into in the 1970s under Carter, to restore the canal by the end of the century, to give the canal zone back to Panama, independent Panama, by December 31st, 1999. And we did. And we pulled our forces, our bases, our military presence out of the Panama Canal zone. And the Panama Canal and that entire zone became just part of Panama. And this was goes back now. Originally, if you want to look at it, our being in there was part of the Hay-Bunai-Varilla Treaty signed in 1903. And if you really want to go into it, Panama was part of Colombia, and we helped Panama actually break away from Colombia. And when we did that, we signed the treaty, which then allowed us sovereignty over a zone where we built the Panama Canal, which linked the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. We want a lot of assurance that we could control that. We want a lot of assurance that this would not fall to any European colonial powers. The French had been trying to build a canal in that same area without success. So we wanted to make sure that when we went in there, we had sovereign control over that vital, what was going to become a very vital waterway. And that's why we asserted that. And that was part of the original Monroe Doctrine. That was part of our thinking, was we want to control this. Therefore, the European powers will be, you know, forestalled from trying to come in and take it over from, you know, a nascent Panamanian government that can't fight, that could not fight against, say, Britain or France or any of the big, or Germany or any of the big, because they're just simply not strong enough, whereas the U.S. is actually strong enough to defend the canal zone. And that's what we did. All right, now the first Panama Canal Treaty stipulated the transfer of all canal operations to Panama. It superseded the Hay-Bunai-Varilla Treaty and established a transition that took place. The second document was the concerning permanent neutrality and operation of the canal zone, and that's the one we've been looking at that guaranteed the canal's future. It said that the waterway would remain neutral and open to all vessels of all nations on equal terms in time of peace and war. And that's where we took a little bit of difference, because of all the things that China had been doing in that area, taking up very large territorial positions on each end of the canal, which gave it certainly the ability to surveil and observe. And these are Chinese-owned corporations that own this, but the Chinese corporations under Chinese law are compelled to do stuff on behalf of the government, to like espionage. And if the government was to ask them to use that as a base for potential military or paramilitary sabotage operations, I have no doubt that those companies would be compelled to do that as well. And that's how the U.S. viewed it. So we said that's bad. And then the China was also helping build a new bridge superstructure that was going to go over the canal itself. And we just saw all of this as a potential threat to that neutrality provision. All right. So it appears for now we've kind of settled that, although the U.S. is now doing military training operations in the canal zone. We've reopened what used to be called Fort Sherman down there, the little Sherman training area, not to be confused with the Fort Sherman that's north of Chicago. And So that is an ongoing operation. Now, the U.S., the reason I bring all this up is because now the U.S. has actually put a big military force into the hemisphere. It's sitting just off the coast of Venezuela. Got an aircraft carrier task force. You got an amphibious ready group with the Marine Expeditionary Unit embarked. And we are actively targeting drug cartel maritime vessels, go-fast boats, and semi-submersibles, and hitting them with kinetic strikes. Once we identify them as carrying drugs, we are hitting them. Not for the criminal activity. We have said that these cartels, we have designated them as terrorist groups. We have gone so far as to designate at least one form of illegal drugs as a weapon of mass destruction. But we have certainly said the cartels are conducting themselves like terrorists. What they're doing fits the definition of terrorism. Frankly, if you look at how the cartels operate, they do operate in the political space, and they do engage in extreme violence for political or social purposes. And one can make a strong argument, as the U.S. is making, that they've been conducting themselves as terrorists, and of course we call them narco-terrorists, for quite some time. And that's our position, and we treat them like terrorist groups anywhere else in the world. If we see a vehicle traveling down the road with a bunch of ISIS terrorists in Syria, we will hit it. We don't stop it, search the vehicle, and then question the individuals and try to take them to a U.S. court to prove they're ISIS. Nope. We hit it with a Hellfire missile or something like that. That's how we handle terrorists operating in the international theater. That is the philosophy, the approach that we are putting on these maritime vessels. And frankly, from what I've seen, we've been hitting maritime vessels engaged in the movement, large movements of drugs. As much as anybody says, they says, well, I haven't seen evidence or whatever it is. I haven't seen evidence that these vessels were anything other than drug vessels. And with some of them, it's pretty clear. When you see a go-fast boat, open go-fast boat, and there's big bales of what appear to be cocaine in that boat, and it's going across the water at 40 or 50 knots in the middle of the night, it's not fishing. Let's just put it that way. All right. And I don't think they're taking refined sugar over to Trinidad and Tobago. So everything I've seen says as it is. So we've got this massive armada. We are pushing for regime change. We don't recognize the Maduro government, the legitimacy of the Maduro government in the last election. We have also said, look, if these cartels, which many of them are based in Mexico, that if the Mexican government can't do something about it, we're going to do military strikes there. Of course, that threatens the sovereignty of Mexico. And I will say, even if not recognizing the Maduro government, if we do military strikes on the sovereign territory of Venezuela, that too would be, quote, an act of war, because you're doing a sovereign strike on another country's sovereign territory. So there is definitely a confrontation brewing here. One would say the confrontation is already in place, and we're kind of stuck right now. We can't, if we withdraw all those military forces from Venezuela, it will be in the information space, it will be portrayed that the U.S. basically chickened out and we withdrew, and that the Maduro government was so strong, so powerful, and Maduro himself was so strong, so powerful, that we couldn't possibly fathom doing a bigger military operation. It was just us making a big threat. And at the end of the day, we had to run away with our tail between our legs. That's not a thing that the U.S. can really afford to do. So we're kind of stuck. But if we go in there and we strike, we don't have an invasion force. That Marine Expeditionary Unit, I'm a little bit biased about Marines. I will say that we are the greatest fighting force the world has ever known, but there ain't that many. You know, a MEU is built around a battalion landing team. We're talking about going against an extremely large Venezuelan force. If you talk about that citizen militia thing, we're talking hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, not very well trained, and certainly not very well equipped, but they've got a lot going on. They've got a lot of manned portable air defense weapons that they could employ against our aircraft. So bottom line is, we don't have an invasion force who could go in there and invade and physically take over Venezuela. All right. It's just not going to happen. But we are being compelled to do strike missions. And the question is, will the strike missions have the effect that we hope? And there is in one scenario, Maduro realizes that he can't withstand this, or a coup overthrows him, and he's out. Another scenario is we do the strike missions and this thing devolves into, and the opposition forces try to take over, but they don't quite take over, or they take over parts, but then it ends up in a massive civil war. Next thing you know, you've already seen under Chavez and Maduro, a third of the population or a fourth of the population of Venezuela take off. You have the threat of even more, and that would be forces, that would be refugees that would flow into Guyana. They'd flow into Colombia. They would flow further south, potentially to Brazil or other countries. And that would be a destabilizing thing to see a massive refugee flow like that. And we don't want to see all those countries, especially Guyana and Colombia, fundamentally destabilized. So that's a big problem. But on the other hand, we don't want to see Venezuela metastasize into a bigger threat. I mean, heaven forbid that Guyana in the 2020s starts thinking like what the Soviets looked at doing in Cuba in the early 1960s, you know, using it, or the Iranians or somebody else, or China, thinking about transferring weapons of mass destruction, perhaps, you know, ballistic missiles or something like that, down there with nuclear warheads. That's a very scary proposition. That would completely change the strategic dynamic in the Western Hemisphere. And we are not going to sit by idly and let that happen, just as we didn't sit by idly and let it happen in Cuba in 1962. So there's a lot going on that could happen. Anyway, I think it's an extremely volatile situation. I want to put some context on some of the things that the White House and President Trump have been saying. Little historical walk, a little walk down history's lane, if you will, in terms of Greenland, Canada, the Panama Canal, and then kind of bring it in and say, and let's look at what's happening in Venezuela and Mexico as well. And by the way, don't forget, it ain't the first time we've been to Mexico, you know, and the Marines we got the halls of Montezuma in there because we were in the halls of Montezuma. Don't forget the Mexican-American War. All right, that's why you have southwestern states that are part of the United States and not part of Mexico. So there's a lot going on there, a lot to consider, a lot of history to think about, but it is a massive strategic shift. There is potential. I've seen this in the business world that there, you know, not just Europe and the Monroe Doctrine, but obviously China and other countries are making into the Western Hemisphere, certainly in economic ways, that is denying the U.S. an opportunity to benefit from where we are. And we do provide a certain amount of strategic or security envelope over this. But with that said, I think we are shifting and we need to be very cautious about the second and third order effects of whatever we do. Any of these scenarios can't be ruled out. And there are implications. If we back down and look weak in the Western Hemisphere, what does that do to our position in Asia? What does that do to our position in the Middle East and in Europe and Africa, for that matter? On the other hand, if we get bogged down into some sort of big war within our hemisphere, what is that going to do for us? So there's a lot of things to think about as we're going forward. Thanks for listening to Strat. Please visit stratpodcast.com. You can go to the Hal Kemper TV channel on YouTube. And of course, you can always go to my corporate website, gripsa.com. Thanks for listening. Hope you listen to the next one as well. And I hope you're having a wonderful holiday season.